and welcome to the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio. From creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences, to audio secrets, here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. This is episode 251. I am Vincent Diamante, and I am so jet-lagged because, I think it's become way too regular this year that I just come back from Japan and record this episode, and I'm... Whatever. I don't think I have all that much fun stuff to talk about. Maybe it's just because this is now the fourth time I've been to Japan this year. Whatever. You don't need to hear about that again. Let's instead go to someone who is much cooler than me and does not need to rely on some globe-trotting exploits in order to show off just how cool he is. Mike, how are you doing?
I actually looked around the room to wonder who you were talking about, but I guess you meant me. I'm doing fairly well, with a little bit of heartbreak in that as you know, Vince, I ordered a new Mac to replace my long overdue of retirement 2013 Mac, and discovered I'm not going to get to see it for at least another month. So I'm in that terrible position of feeling like my new machine is, you know how you get a new machine and you retroactively feel worse about your existing machine because you want to feel better about the thing you just bought? So imagine going through that process and sort of mentally relegating your current computer to the status of obsolete and then realizing you have to work with it for another month. A little bit awkward. But yeah. the short answer to your question is I'm doing great.
That's awesome. Sorry to hear about your Mac travails, but I'm sure that'll be rectified in due time. And maybe a couple episodes later, we can compare some notes when it comes to those new Macs, because they're pretty awesome. Hey, Alex, why don't you get on the Mac bandwagon?
Don't tempt me, Vince. Don't tempt me. I kind of am on the Mac bandwagon because I use a Mac for business. So I actually have a nice... What color is it called again? Rose gold? Gold?
Ah, pinky, the best.
Pink gold MacBook M1 Air sitting right here, which I use for all of my business stuff. But yeah, unfortunately, because of being held against our will to a PC because of working on VR stuff, unfortunately, the PC is the main platform for everything else. Although, to be honest, yes, I would also rather be working on a Mac just so that I don't have to be switching computers all the time for business stuff and creative stuff. I'm pretty good, thanks. It's getting darker and the days are getting shorter rapidly here in Sweden right now. And, you know, one of the things I really like about Sweden is that the four seasons are so, so markedly different. And here we are in autumn, fall for... For the audiences who you would call it that. Very nice to be on the show with you both again today. We have a full house today, a full complement. That's nice.
It is pretty nice having the trio here. It's been a few months, I would say, since the full trio has been here. But it's really nice to be able to share everything that's been going on. And there's always something going on when it comes to games and audio, and hopefully this time around we don't have to deal with all the negativity that came around and just sort of threw itself about in the game development sphere that just been crazy. Thankfully all that has not exactly relaxed, but it's still certainly going on, what with Unity and I think I just messed that up. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Unity is now a few weeks behind us, but now, in a sort of weird intersection of games and music, Unreal and Epic is in the news with their handling of Bandcamp. And we talked about this a little bit earlier in the year when they actually acquired Bandcamp. It seemed a little strange that they would do this, and that it seemed for most of the year they were really quite hands off with Bandcamp. They were left to just sort of do things the way they usually do, business as usual. But now Bandcamp is changing hands. Epic has admitted that they need to make some moves, not just Bandcamp, but elsewhere in that whole Epic Games universe. And now Bandcamp is in the hands of something called SongTrader, which I really don't know that much about, other than they facilitate musicians and placement in various stuff. So that is a thing that's going on. And with that, a little bit of anxiety for the various artists out there, especially game music composers for whom Bandcamp is one of those things that they could rely on. Like in that last episode where we were talking about Terrence and his soundtracks to things like Tunic, going down thanks to spurious DMCA attacks. And he could rely on Bandcamp. Now, I wonder what Bandcamp is doing. That stuff is all up in the air. Have you guys been hearing much about Bandcamp and perhaps people who are using that?
It's so important, really, isn't it, Bandcamp? Like, it's just, you know, it's almost a miracle that it's still around, you know, with the ubiquity of Spotify and Apple Music and YouTube Music and all of the streaming platforms. It's such an important presence, really. And you know, just the sort of old-fashioned approach, we can call it old-fashioned, I guess, where, you know, the artist uploads their music, and then if you like the music, you buy it and you download it, or you listen to it via Bandcamp's app. And it's, you know, it's all nice and simple and plain, and the money, obviously there's a revenue split that goes to Bandcamp, but a very fair proportion of that goes to the artists themselves so that they can sustain themselves and make more music. What a novel idea. What an incredible business model this is. it's really, really important that Bandcamp stays around, and ideally it's you know, even better if Bandcamp can strengthen itself and its position and that traditional business approach of just buying music that you like, as opposed to expecting it to be something that you can just access for free. I don't know. Do either of you know anything about the new owner of Bandcamp? I mean, at least they're in the music industry, I guess, with a name like that. But are there any other details that you've heard about them?
Not so much. I've only known the little bit about SongTrader that I've spent some 10 minutes looking into. It seems like a lot of it has to do with music placement and music licensing rather than what Bandcamp is, which is this very direct music marketplace for artists. So this seems like new territory for them in terms of this very different service from what they were previously providing. I know some people that are on Bandcamp, and it's always been really cool to see their stuff there. Sometimes I go ahead and purchase it there, even as I continue to stream their music on places like Spotify or Apple Music, which I've recently been trying to mess around with Apple Music since I'm more and more in the Apple ecosystem. What about you, Mike? Do you know anyone that works with Bandcamp for their music catalog?
I have a small presence on Bandcamp, though I don't generally try to monetize it. I sometimes will park a project there where I don't want to go through the hoops of putting it on a streaming service. Or maybe it's a project that's kind of in progress, so that seems like it's a good place to park it. But I do know a few artists who have a meaningful commercial presence on Bandcamp, and a couple of cases where there actually is no streaming release, so that if you want to hear the music, you have to buy it, old school. And I agree with Alex that it's very important to have that be at least an option for artists who want to take that route. And what was beautiful about Bandcamp is it seemed like it fit this niche where it was professional enough to do the job it was set out to do, but it had a kind of grassrootsy, informal, not too polished vibe to it that I think was very welcoming to artists as well as visitors. So I'm not aware that it changed significantly when it was bought by Epic. Correct me if I'm wrong, I might be. But I think what we can hope is that it doesn't really change in the hands of its new ownership.
Yeah, I think that is really the hope. Yeah, that informal and grassrootsy nature that you referred to. I know some people feel that it's perhaps a little too unpolished, but there is something very inviting about just seeing that very plain sort of storefront where, oh, this is it. This is the artist providing their music, and I can listen to it, and then I can purchase it. And it's very, very simple. It really shows off its 2007 roots. Bandcamp has been around for more than 15 years, and it feels like it hasn't really updated its look in that time, but that's okay because it really is all about that. It's directly supporting the artists and not much else. I do have some friends that have mentioned that they really wish that the quality of the web audio player that Bandcamp uses would be better. But otherwise, it's hard to think about any serious negative responses that people have actually levied against Bandcamp. Everyone I know just really hopes that that Epic before and now SongTrader doesn't mess with the formula, and it remains to be seen. This is a new party that I don't really know all that much about, and you look at SongTrader's website, that is a very polished website talking about how they're trusted by Sony and Unilever and Heineken. Okay, that's a little bit different from what Bandcamp was offering to us.
I don't think it takes like a extreme, you know, business analyst to look at the moves that Bandcamp has taken over the past, you know, 10, 15 years. And I don't think it takes that much skill in business analysis to see that they definitely know what they're doing. And, you know, that you describe it as unpolished. It's interesting with Bandcamp. I've never felt that it's particularly unpolished, but it definitely has that kind of DIY punk feeling to it. It really screams, you know, indie world. And I think that when you look at Bandcamp's, I don't know if you've ever looked through Bandcamp's documentation, but it's incredibly well written. It's very humorous. It's very, very personable. It's written very, very cleverly to sort of make you feel like, okay, I'm not dealing with a corporation here. I'm dealing with, it feels like, you know, just a bunch of people in somebody's garage running a website that you can sell your music on, you know. And I remember that I think there was actually one time when Bandcamp had put Gallagher in its banner header up the top of a help page. Did you see that?
I don't remember that. When was that?
That was, I think, about 10 years ago when I was using Bandcamp for something and I was looking at the help page and there was a playable version of Gallagher in the banner header at the top of the page. And I thought, this is great. or was it Space Invaders? It might have been Space Invaders, but anyway.
There's a general phenomenon that I think we've been witness to in audio over the years, which is when beloved service or website or company is purchased by larger company. And usually, I think our biggest aspirations are that the larger company doesn't destroy what we loved about the service. And anecdotally, I can only come up with one example where that happened and the results were good, which is when Apple bought eMagic and took over Logic. Can you think of any other case where some audio developer or service was bought out by something larger and that we were happy with the result?
Jeez, that Logic example is a really good example.
Good question. I'm just thinking of, back to.
It's certainly not in Music and Moog, because
that happened this week too, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. So we actually were talking a little bit about Moog. I think two or three episodes back when InMusic purchased them, and now it looks like most of Moog is now gone, laid off, and the original Moog studio is just a shell of itself now. Just happened.
Can I say Roland and Boss?
Oh!
That's
different.
Was Boss actually an independent company originally, or was Boss just a brand of Roland?
I think it was more the latter.
Okay, so that doesn't count then. There's a lot of sort of this kinds of relationships in the music industry as well. Like, for example, at least on the bass side, Yamaha. Well, that could be a good example, perhaps, is Yamaha's work with Steinberg, because Yamaha owns Steinberg, right?
That is actually true. And that I think that has actually had beneficial impact on Steinberg as a whole.
Yeah, I think Steinberg doesn't, at least from my observation, I mean, I've been a 85% full-time Cubase user for, what'll it be, maybe 4 years now. And in that time, you know, Cubase has in a sense, you know, really gone from strength to strength and improved greatly over that time. And it doesn't really appear that Yamaha is doing anything that's particularly, inhibiting Steinberg's aspirations for their own products. If anything, you know, just looking at Steinberg's moves over the past time that I've been involved with them with Cubase, when you think of Dorico and you think of their other products and the progress that they've been making, you know, potentially it could be that Yamaha has been actually having sort of a positive strategic influence over Steinberger, who can really know what happens in those boardroom meetings. But
the example of Dorico is interesting because you can point it out as an example of a small group being bought out by a big company to very positive effect. Steinberg basically financed the development of Dorico after the developers were cast out of Sibelius, the company that they started. On the other hand, that situation was a result of the negative version of these events, where big company Avid bought out Sibelius and then made a series of what we would consider generally disastrous decisions, resulting in the departure of the original team. So even though in the end, I think this was very good for the notation software sub-industry, it's both positive and negative as it reflects on the impact of a takeover.
And also on that point with Yamaha and Steinberg, there's another aspect to it too. I think Vince, maybe 5 or 6 episodes ago, we were talking about audio interfaces, Vince, and you said that rather surprisingly, and I was very surprised too, Steinberg interfaces, their audio interfaces that are branded as Steinberg, they contain Yamaha componentry. They're made by Yamaha, I guess, but they're branded as Steinberg. You said that I think those interfaces actually have, you know, earned themselves quite a good reputation and are very reliable, and Yamaha does quite a good job with, together with Steinberg, in maintaining the software support for those, and they sound good. And was there something like that you mentioned, Vince?
Yeah, actually, because of the consistency of their hardware platform that they've built them on, that also makes for a very consistent software driver layer. So there's a lot of support that's been built up over not just the newest interfaces, but this whole family of interfaces branded Yamaha and Steinberg over the years. And it's that consistency has also led to driver reliability as well. So definitely good products there and good customer interactions as a result of these good products. So pretty good there for Yamaha and Steinberg. I'm not entirely a non-Steinberg user, since I'm a Dorico user as well. And yeah, it is really interesting how all these acquisitions have resulted in all these things happening. Avid acquiring Sibelius. And of course, nowadays, I think a lot of the negative things that are coming from Avid are because of all these acquisitions that have been happening this year, because they were just acquired last month by this private equity group called Symphony Technology. Despite the Symphony name, they're not really known for music software. They just happen to have a whole lot of moving parts, I suppose, somewhat like a symphony. Symphony Retail AI is kind of their big product there. So yeah, that's a lot of crazy moving stuff happening in music as a business, and not just all the music goods that we interact with.
Yeah, well, let's just hope that Bandcamp can continue to thrive and grow and maintain its very, very important presence, not only as a platform for purchasing music, of course, but for everything it represents in that, you know, the continuing on that idea that music has value, as you know, a piece of music can be sold for something, is actually something that you can pay for, which of course in this day and age is becoming increasingly a foreign concept to most people. Like, you know, the average consumer who wants to listen to something, they don't expect to have to pay for it. They can just go to Spotify or Apple Music or any of these streaming services, and they expect to be able to listen to it for free. So having something like Bandcamp, where you can either, you have some cases where, as you said, Vince, people will be having their presence entirely on Bandcamp and not anywhere else. Or the alternative, such as your case, where, yeah, you can listen to Vincent Diamante on Spotify. But if you want to actually directly support Vincent Diamante, you can actually go and buy his stuff on Bandcamp. And that's a kind of like almost a Patreon-esque style of direct support of the artist, as opposed to through, you know, having Vince earn 0.00001% of what Taylor Swift is how many streams that she gets, or however it is that Spotify works. Isn't that the case, that like the total streams and then the percentage of those that belong to one artist is the percentage of money that they make out of the total amount, or something like that? Was it something? I think that's the way Spotify works, isn't it?
I think that's how it works. God, the math behind that is so crazy. I don't even remember how many decimal points there are there.
Yeah.
Too many decimal points, but whatever. Music has value. Let's agree on that.
Music has value.
What with all the music talk over the last few weeks, with music distribution, this stuff about Bandcamp, you mentioned you have a little bit of a Bandcamp presence, but you primarily work with other means, like with a DSP or some other distro type service. What's your primary go-to when it comes to providing your music out there for the end listener?
I'm still with CD Baby, probably more out of historical inertia than fondness at this point. CD Baby used to have excellent customer service, both in terms of response time and I think general empathy. In the past, where there was an issue, they would respond very quickly and apologetically if necessary. And I find that response time and quality of response have dropped significantly. So I'm still with them for now, and it is convenient to have all your stuff in one place. So I think that's the sticky glue for me right now. But next soundtrack album I release, I might ask y'all and other colleagues what they recommend and just see what the latest group of offerings are, because there's new contenders in this space all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I'm probably going to be doing something similar. I've been with TuneCore for a while, and I'm interested in seeing what else is out there. It does seem like there are a lot of other options out there. I know that, Alex, you kind of you turned me on to Sounddrop mostly because of the ease of dealing with multi-artist releases, which we were part of. And so that was great. I know that there's more stuff out there, but it's also really hard when you already have built up this relationship with a DSP, even if they don't offer that much to the relationship. And if anything, it's been degrading over time, that level of service.
Yeah, Sounddrop, I think, was in the news just a few weeks ago. Some kind of, was it either in the news or I just read some general sentiment somewhere that, yeah, avoid Sounddrop because of this and that and this. Oh, I think Sounddrop was the one that was involved together with the Tunic soundtrack.
Oh, that was, yes.
Yeah.
Terrence was working with Sounddrop.
Yeah.
But they've been less than responsive.
Yeah, I think, you know, unfortunately, I don't think that there's any real, you know, like this is clearly the answer. Everybody should be using this. When we were doing the Space Folk City soundtrack together, Vince, and when it came to do the release for that, yeah, as you said, the reason that I chose Sounddrop was purely because their interface for handling splitting up revenue between multiple artists who work on the same album was very intuitive and quite easy to set up, as opposed to the other options. I can't remember. DistroKid was the other one that I'd used previously. But I think, unfortunately, pretty much like social media, any one of the social media platforms always has its fair share of controversy and fair share of reasons that you should not use it. And I think that's probably, unfortunately, the case right now with all of these. Yeah, the music industry, it'll be interesting to see, you know, in the next 30 or 40 years, hopefully, if we're all still around, it'll be interesting to see how the music industry changes and evolves. Because when you think about where we are today in 2023, with the state of the music industry, the state of the value behind music, comparing that to, say, 40 years ago, it's just such an entirely different landscape. And now, you know, the way, if you want to be a professional musician, chances are you're probably in game audio. And that of course was definitely not the case in 1983, when it was much more, I wouldn't say viable, because you still have to have a lot of connections and you have to be extremely talented and you have to be in the right place at the right moment in 1983 to be a professional musician. But nowadays, professional music producer, nowadays, whilst on the one hand, everybody and anybody can produce high quality music from the comfort of their room with their laptop, on the other, which wasn't the case in 1983, on the other side of that is like, yeah, are you going to make any money from doing that? No, not likely. So come and join us in game audio.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It's a funny state of affairs, isn't it? But very positive for us, because in our realm, there's more and more people who are contributing to this art form, and that's of course helping to increase general public awareness for the importance of that music takes, the role that it has in gameplay. And of course, yeah, the more amazing, talented people making amazing, incredible soundtracks for games, the better, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Actually, on that point, there was a topic that I was interested to get your view on. So I'm currently playing Starfield, and I think I remember last episode we just sort of went over my general thoughts about Starfield, so I'm still playing Starfield. Something occurred to me the other day while playing that there's pretty much constant music as you're playing, like all through, the music just doesn't stop. I mean, it sort of, you know, nicely, gracefully warps and transitions between different cues as different things happen in the game, but it is a constant soundtrack. And I might be wrong about that. There might be some key moments of silence, but if there are, they're clearly so well sequenced into the gameplay experience that I haven't noticed them. So that's great. But wow. Yeah, the idea of like just constant music in gameplay. So just maybe leave aside loading screens, although in general most games have music through loading screens, but like just when you think about what the player experiences in a game, what would you say is the right time to be designing a music spec that is just ongoing all the way through a game? And what would be a time when that's maybe not the best idea, where you do want to have a period where there is no music and you are letting things focus on the sound effects? What would you say is like a kind of a good rule of thumb for people to consider when they're making those aesthetic structural choices about a game music's game score?
For arcade games and things that are very short form, just go for it, bam! And then the longer form stuff, probably not. But what you just described flies totally in the face of that. And I still haven't touched Starfield, so that was a real, real surprise that is in fact how the music is being delivered. But, Mike, have you played Starfield yet?
I have not, because I'm still on Team PlayStation. I've been following the reviews avidly, and I am very curious about it. And in fact, on that on that topic. Alex, have you found with the continual music that you're recognizing repeated pieces, or is there sufficient diversity and variety of score that you're not getting the sense of hearing the same music over and over again?
You definitely do get the sense that you're hearing the same music over and over again. However, it's done very, very well, such that it's kind of a comforting thing to have the same music over and over again, as opposed to an annoying thing. I'm 37 hours into gameplay at the moment, and I haven't yet got to the point of thinking, oh, okay, not this queue again. I really need to turn this off because I'm getting so bored of it. You know, the who was it again, Vince, who did the soundtrack?
It was Enon Zero.
Yeah. And I guess the experience really, really shows, because like there hasn't been any point where I've just felt like, oh, this is so boring. Like I've heard this so many times and I'm getting tired of it. The composer's done an excellent job in slotting it into the experience in a nice way that even if you do notice the repetition of the cues, it feels reassuring and comforting to have that something that you recognize there as opposed to repetitive and annoying and tedious.
I think Elden Ring also had a score that fell into that category where you would definitely recognize the music after you spent some time in the world, but it was, I'll say, translucent. It felt like it was part of the landscape. And therefore, it didn't grate on you after you heard it over and over again. It was evocative, but not intrusive. And I think that when you're talking about atmospheric music, that's the real art. If you're going to have wall-to-wall music, you know, it really has to know how to blend into the scenery. Whereas I think the case where Vince was pointing out, where you've got an action game and music can be much more overt, and the in-your-face quality of the music can actually be a fun asset of the game when you've got that level of kinetic energy going on.
Mm-hmm. So I guess this begs the next question. What are some, like, how do you do that? how do you make a soundtrack that doesn't feel repetitive and that can be, you know, like this nice bed underneath the experience that even if it does sound repetitive, it is repetitive in a contributory is that a word in a good way that benefits the experience? It is now. One thing I would say is that in both of your realms, when you're working with textural sound or orchestral arrangements, it is a fair bit easier. I have noticed that because obviously in my wheelhouse is electronic music of all different varieties, and electronic music is obviously very focused on rhythm, percussion, bass line, key signature, synthesizer usage and stuff like that. And when you've got that sort of narrow constraint from a genre point of view, it becomes incredibly hard to do that in a way that doesn't feel repetitive. And a specific example of this is Cyberpunk. By the way, Cyberpunk, the latest update, and also the recent Phantom Liberty DLC is absolutely incredible. I'm very biased because I've always been a huge fan of the game right from its rocky release and rocky beginnings. But if you haven't played Cyberpunk, now is a really, really good time to do it because a lot of the kinks have been ironed out in the game design, leaving you to really thoroughly enjoy the just incredible, incredible work. Artistic, the musical work, the voice acting work, the sound effects, absolutely superb. Anyway, Cyberpunk, the combat music is sort of like this, some industrial techno influences in there, and it's techno. It's really, really quite repetitive, you know, when it's coming up over and over again. It's not a case of, oh, here's that combat music. Yeah, the combat music. I love the combat music. Unfortunately, it's not that. It's like, oh, it's the combat music. Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, you get, it's quite repetitive and quite tedious, mm-hmm. in my personal opinion. I mean, it's really well produced and fits perfectly into the game. But I wouldn't categorize it in the same way as I would Starfield, where, you know, when the, when the music has this cue, you feel, yeah, this is this cue again. I love this cue. I'm glad to hear it again. It's not like that, unfortunately. So what would you say is like some general tips other than Alex's advice here is don't do electronica?
Well, I immediately think of Nino Kuni when thinking about combat music that grates, which is surprising because Nino Kuni had as its composer Joe Hisaishi, who is a fantastic composer, especially for films like Spirited Away and Princess Mononoke and the B. Takeshi films outside of the Ghibli stuff. But those leitmotifs, when they come in again, are just so annoying. Okay, you hear the battle music, and you got this big, like, mid-low brass figure. It's like, okay, yeah, it's the battle music again. That's annoying. You just want to get... You are so done with it. Like, in any other case... when you're thinking, oh, you know, here is a fantastic cue by a wonderful composer that has a wonderful control over the orchestra and the texture and the orchestration. And, oh, I love his leitmotifs, except when you hear them just repeated verbatim for the 100th, 200th time with these RPG battles. So I don't think... working with an orchestra is this sort of panacea for the problem here.
Yeah, actually, if I can just interject one funny example of another justification of what you just said, there is the Xevious soundtrack, because that's definitely very electronic, and it's basically what, 8 notes, whatever it is, and that for some reason, I don't, maybe it's like the childhood nostalgia aspect. For some reason, the Xevious soundtrack doesn't get repetitive, even though it's only like 6 or 4 or 5 notes or whatever it is. But sorry, yes, please continue.
Well, I mean, I think there's something there. Like, is it a distinct leitmotif? Is it a texture? Is it just a feeling? Yes, like that Ni no Kuni soundtrack in many ways is an excellent soundtrack, but having these battle cues with these very specific leitmotifs that are used in a fairly limited ways, because he didn't write that much music for this role-playing game that has hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of combat battles that you engage in. I do get tired of those leitmotifs, even as the music itself is quite good. How would I do it? I'm really not sure, but Mike, do you have any cool examples or thoughts on this?
Well, I think one important principle where game music is concerned is to try to avoid a one-to-one mapping of trigger to particular piece of music. And you can look at it both a good and bad example in the same game if you think of Elder Scrolls V Skyrim. Which I think does an exceptional job of recycling atmospheric exploration music in a way that does not become tedious. On the other hand, it would have certain moments in the game where you always felt like the same trigger was causing the same music. So I think that when you had to fight incidental dragons, you know, just walking down the street, suddenly a dragon appears because it was they had a random encounter. I think you would always get the same dragon combat music. So it was, it was, not only was it tedious, but it also clued you in unambiguously as to what was going to happen. And I think often in game music, we like presaging emotions, but we don't want to presage particular events, meaning we do want the music to say something scary is happening or something unsettling or something wonderful, but we don't want the music to say monster type B is about to show up, right? That's the wrong kind of foreshadowing. So, but on the positive side, I think it was Jeremy Soule who wrote that music. I think Skyrim's atmospheric music is a perfect use of non-obvious musical structure. You know, there wasn't an obvious A section, B section repetition in the music. Use of tempo and durational values in the melodies that made the music really feel like it was flowing along with your exploration. And there you would hear recognizable melodies emerge from the textures, and I think anyone who'd been playing Elder Scrolls for a long time would recognize motifs from prior games. But they always seemed to emerge organically and gently in a way that did not grate and did not feel repetitive. So both a positive role model and a cautionary tale in the same game score.
Hmm. Those Elder Scrolls games really did a bang-up job when it came to their soundtracks. They're wonderful soundtracks to listen to as well as to sort of live in the environment. But yeah, sometimes it doesn't have to hit it all perfectly out of the park. And yeah, I definitely feel you when it comes to the whole one-to-one thing being something that you want to avoid. I've always thought it was interesting that, especially in the context of role-playing games, that battles, after a certain point, do become these rote, unexciting things that you just go through the process of for various reasons, whether it be because you are 50 hours into a game and you have mastered the system as a player, or because you have, after playing for 50 hours, you decide to go back to an earlier area of the game and you have no problem using your huge Excalibur-like sword against a lowly slime. So that's really not much of a battle there either. But there's all sorts of interesting possibilities for the music conveying different aspects of the interaction that you're dealing with. Like, you know, battle music doesn't necessarily have to be a battle. You know, much like romance music doesn't necessarily have to be about romance in the very, you know, typical way, like, oh, Mendelssohn. Or, you know, suspense music doesn't necessarily have to be like, oh, yes, I'm going to, you know, play off of Lalo Schifrin for something, you know? You know, being super tropey and just doing things as expected is definitely not a fun way to do things, either from a composer's standpoint, in my opinion, or from a player's standpoint. Well, I guess also in my opinion, because I am a player, as much as I haven't been playing games lately. But whatever, whatever.
Interesting point. And I like coming back to the original question then, you know, aside from issues with repetition, assuming that you are capable of, you know, making a score that can sort of seamlessly repeat itself without players really finding it tedious or annoying, when is a good time to... Is there a good justification and reason in when you're designing a music structure for a game to say, okay, we want music for the entirety that the player is playing? Like, they have to be hearing music all the time, right from the title screen, you know, straight into the loading screen and then into the gameplay, and then whatever you're doing in the game is just constant music. What would be, you know, what would be an example of a situation where that's something you absolutely really should do to heighten the experience versus a situation where maybe that's going to actually, by doing that, you would forfeit some good opportunities to take, you know, benefit from the impact that silence can have, or that not necessarily silence, but the impact that you can get from, you know, allowing the player to focus on the sound effects for a moment and having no music.
I think Vince brought up a good example of short form action games where you want all adrenaline all the time. I think it's reasonable in those cases to have wall to wall music. And indeed, you know, that genre traditionally does take that approach. It's much more interesting with a durationally long gameplay experience, as we would get in open world games where you're spending dozens and dozens of hours and can't hope to fill all that time with new music, which would be, you know, our dream scenario. And I think in those cases, I feel like there'd be a really hard argument to have wall-to-wall music for a long, extended gameplay experience without any kind of reprieve. But I know it's certainly been done. In those cases, I tend to advocate, you know, when I work on longer form games, I tend to advocate periods of silence, even if it's just a few seconds between iterations of one of several background cues, just to let the ear relax for a second and to, as you say, Alex, to kind of enjoy the atmosphere a little bit and to perhaps make the reentry of music a little more unobtrusive. Whereas if you know you're getting atmospheric cues back to back, the anticipation of the next cue can sometimes be distracting, irrespective of how much you like the cue itself. So I think especially variable length silence can be part of the general game audio principle of variety. And if you can vary the frequency of music, you're adding to that unpredictability that helps fight against loop-itis.
I think that's absolutely right. And also another benefit of having silence is that you might find that the sense of tedium that comes from having music cues repeat could be lessened if you, you know, if you, rather than sort of transitioning from this cue to that cue back to the first cue again, when it comes in the second time, it's kind of a case of, oh, here's this again. Because the music is constant, you may have you may be building up an expectation that the music is going to be doing more, and so when it starts repeating itself, it may unnecessarily draw too much attention to the fact that it's just repeating again and again. Whereas instead, if you removed that middle the middle piece there, so you have this cue, then you have silence, allow the player to focus on sound effects. Or other kinds of, you know, ambient noise or things like that for sort of a feeling of immersion, and then back to the first cue again and it comes in again, of course you're going to feel, oh, it's that song again, but perhaps the sense of, you may be able to achieve something like what Starfield does with its clever score, where, yes, it's that cue again, but it doesn't feel repetitive, annoying, or tedious. It just feels familiar, and instead there's a positive benefit from that. So, yeah, perhaps the intentional usage of no music can help to reduce that sense of tedium.
I totally agree.
Me too. I was recently checking out this little documentary. You might know him. We've mentioned him on this show in the past, this YouTuber by the name of Alex Ball, who sometimes does these documentaries on synthesis and synthesizers and soundtracks. And he recently did a little mini documentary on the Wendy Carlos soundtrack Tron.
I just watched that today. It's absolutely fantastic. Highly recommend it. I love everything Alex Ball does, but this mini documentary that he made was, because Tron is my favorite movie of all time.
It is.
And I absolutely love Wendy Carlos's soundtrack for it. And so this was like, yeah, as soon as I saw it, click, right? I'm supposed to be working, but screw that. I have to see this now.
It's fantastic. The 15 minutes, 20 minutes, it's worth it. But he mentions something similar there, where there was a cue that she wrote for the light cycles. And okay, it's a cool cue, but having this moment where you can actually just sort of savor the sound effects design that is happening in this very special and intense moment in the film. And like, there is a temptation to be like, yes, we can heighten it even more with music, but sometimes you can also take that opportunity to step back and do something different and give the listener and the viewer a little bit of a different perspective and thereby receive all of this stuff visually, aurally, even more differently. And that creates a really exciting contrast there, not just energy for energy's sake.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Because in that scene, I had actually not noticed until Alex Ball pointed it out in his documentary that, yeah, indeed, there is no music in that scene. And it's really, when it's pointed out to you, you realize, wow, that's really, really clever. Because it would probably be the most, out of everything that happens in that movie, it probably would be the easiest to score scene out of the entire thing, right? I mean, it's got, you know, you've got these light bikes and it's very fast and there's action and, you know, there's that sense of elation Wow, my favorite movie of all time. I have to go watch it again because I've just totally blanked on the names of the characters who are in that scene. there's that sense of elation when they win and they escape and he gets off that grid there. But it's actually because there's no music, it becomes incredibly tense. And because there's music through most of the rest of the movie, and that scene doesn't have any music, it's just a very, very strong sense of tension. It really like kind of hones your focus in on what's going on, because of the action being much more easily relatable. It's so effective and it's such a clever choice, despite how easy it would have been to make some kind of soundtrack that would fit that scene. Yeah, what a brilliant decision not to do anything there. There's definitely a lot for us game audio composers to learn from the way that movies handle silence, or as in no music.
There's another famous example, if you go even further back in film history, with the Alfred Hitchcock movie North by Northwest, where there's a scene where I think it's Cary Grant is the protagonist, and he's in a kind of a rural environment, and there's this crop duster plane in the background that's seemingly innocuous, but over time we come to realize, no, the crop duster plane is actually malevolent and kind of makes a dive bomb for him. And that entire stretch is silent, and it's much more effective for that reason. It was kind of famously and intentionally, sorry, I didn't mean silent, that's a very music-centric way of looking at it, but dry of score. And it's another really famous and very powerful example of the absence of music in an otherwise very music-rich film having artistic impact on its own.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely need to watch that again. I think the last time I actually watched that was back when I was in film school. but yes, I remember that scene so vividly, and just thinking about that, as action and cinematography was back then, you know, you look at any particular still from it, you're like, okay, yeah, whatever, this is fine, but it's really packaged so wonderfully there. And yes, in addition, the use of the sound there in order to keep that intensity there happening with that relative lack of music there in order to heighten it. So let's see, we've been talking about some media, so it might be a good time to actually go right into conspicuous consumption. Have there been any cool things that we've been watching or listening to lately? Let's start with you, Mike. It feels like it's been a while since you've been on the show. I'm really interested to hear what you've been checking out over the last few months.
Well, this last week, I was listening to the soundtrack to Traffic, which is, I think, a 90s-era movie about the drug war and its consequences, both on a personal level and on kind of a societal level, with some surprisingly good performances by Michael Douglas. But what was interesting about this score is it was an early example of a atmospheric synth score. This actually ties into our prior topic very interestingly, that was very ambient and kind of blended in with the color palette of the film somehow. Psycho, like sort of making a visual audio analogy, you know, like the sort of sepia tones of the film kind of matched the choice of synth pads and instrumentation of the score, at least in my own internal association. But listening to it now, I feel like it's aged rather well in aiming for this kind of abstract musical space that is, I think, fairly common today in TV music, but at the time was much less so. So it's not necessarily a score that is melodically going to grab you, but texturally and in terms of color and choice of synth textures, I think it's a really, for a working composer, it's a very instructive and interesting score.
That sounds really awesome. I vaguely remember the movie. I don't remember the soundtrack at all, so I'm just going to actually cue that up for myself. Do you remember that, Alex?
I do not, but it definitely sounds like something that I would enjoy, so I'm going to have to go and look. Going to have to go and listen immediately, I think.
Well, what have you been listening to?
Well, this week has been pretty busy with the with music production, with meaning that I've have been listening to my own stuff.
Hey, if you want to talk about that, that's cool too.
No. But
okay.
Yeah, what I have been listening to when I haven't been listening to my own stuff is very, very excitingly, I've spoken about this band before quite a few times, I think, because they're probably my favorite progressive metal group. They're called Tesseract, and Tesseract have released in full now their latest album, which is called War of Being. Regular listeners will probably be thinking, oh, okay, here he goes on again about Tesseract. So I'll just say it's really, really good and I'm enjoying it very much. But it's called War of Being. It's by Tesseract. That's Tesseract and then a capital T. I would classify it as progressive metal with some incredible musicianship, some great great performances and great composition. And yeah, you get the idea. It's great. It's fantastic. It's amazing. That's all. Vince, how about you?
All right. Let's see. I've been listening to this Japanese media composer, this guy named Yuki Hayashi, who is really quite good. And he's done a lot of stuff over the last, decade or so that he's been working in this space. If you are somewhat into anime, you might know him from soundtracks like My Hero Academia and Haikyuu and stuff that is very much targeted at a juvenile teenage audience, a lot of excitement and heroes. And but I've been listening to some of the quieter stuff. So there's a soundtrack that he wrote for this anime that is based on a novel called Run with the Wind, which is, you could describe it as, oh, it's one of those sports anime. But it's rather more quiet because it just deals with a college that is trying to build up a running team for the, I want to say it's Ekiben, and that's not Ekiben, Ekiden. It is this annual event where you have a relay long distance running team from each of these colleges going between all the traditional stations. And it's not exactly the most high flying type of sport. So the focus is very much on the characters and the drama and the interesting things that happen, because it is a very interesting set of characters. It's very grounded. There's no supernatural stuff or crazy heroic shenanigans at play. It's a very quiet and interesting and dramatic soundtrack that is also very, very elegant and very, very beautifully rendered and well performed. And it's actually really nice to listen to a soundtrack like this, which doesn't sound like too many other soundtracks that you hear in the Japanese anime space. So that's what I'm listening to, this soundtrack to Run with the Wind by Yuki Hayashi.
Jeez, Vince, from after that description, I think I missed my opportunity to go into more detail about this new album by Tesseract.
But unfortunately, we're out of time. So
we're out of time. What a shame.
Oh, no. That's right. I guess we are only an hour. Let's do that. This has been episode 251 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked what you heard, feel free to support us by subscribing to us at your podcast purveyor of choice and leaving us a review to keep us in the forefront of the algorithm. You can also follow us on X at Game Audio Hour, where we post notices about episodes as they drop, as well as try to support some other fun and positive voices out there in the social media landscape. And of course, the easy way to do all of this without having to remember any of what I said is to go to GameAudioHour.com. That's GameAudioHour.com. So go ahead and do that while I tear down my studio. I'm going to tear down my studio right now. Because this place is going to be demoed on Monday.
Good luck.
I hope to have something to hear for next time.
Yeah, hopefully. I'm kind of scared about this, but yeah, this will be my first time doing it. It's gonna be the birth of